ABC News, World News This Week. I'm Roger Skibanus, ABC News. Listen.
As the Soviet Union asserts its right to supply arms to those whom it supports in Afghanistan, we do as well.
I am announcing that the Department of Transportation is launching a preliminary investigation of Texas Air Corporation and its management.
I'd like to thank about 30,000 people who helped us make this picture. It took 4 years to make and was very, very rewarding.
In a moment, the people and stories that made this week's world news.
There is a war raging in this country. It is a war against the number one killer of teenagers, drinking and driving. In fact, in less than an hour, another teenager will be added to the list. But while the war rages on, the battle against drinking and driving is being won. Teenagers from coast to coast are banding together to eliminate their number one killer. It's a new generation of students who believe they have to look out for their friends, who believe if the problem of drinking and driving is their problem, then they can solve it. They're daring to dream they have the power to eliminate drunk driving among teenagers. This public service announcement has been brought to you by SAD, Students Against Driving Drunk. For more information on how you can join the fight against drinking and driving, write to SAD, Post Office Box 800, Marlboro, Massachusetts, 01752. We're winning the war, but we still need your help.
Afghanistan. It has been called the Soviets' Vietnam. The USSR got involved in Afghanistan pretty much the same way the U.S. did in Vietnam, bit by bit, until it too found itself mired in a no-win situation. The Kremlin's full-scale troop involvement began late in 1979 and led to the international boycott of the 1980 Summer Olympic Games in Moscow and worsening U.S.-Soviet relations. There was no real effort to end the fighting between the Soviet and Afghan government troops and the Mujahideen rebels backed by the U.S. and Pakistan until mid-1985, when secret talks began in Geneva. Those United Nations-sponsored talks and the 1987 summit meeting between President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev held in Washington led to this week's ceremony in Geneva, presided over by U.N. Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar.
The documents which have just been signed constitute a most significant achievement. They represent a major stride in the effort to bring peace to Afghanistan and ensure reprieve for its people.
The most visible aspect of the peace agreement will be the withdrawal of Soviet troops starting next month. But while the Soviets and the United States agreed not to interfere in Afghanistan's internal affairs, Secretary of State George Shultz says both countries will still be involved in another way.
As the Soviet Union asserts its right to supply arms to those whom it supports in Afghanistan, we do as well. As far as we can see, there's nothing in this that explicitly restricts the United States in any way.
And since the peace agreement does not provide for a ceasefire, it's a foregone conclusion that the rebels will continue their fight against the current Afghan government. Just this week, rebel gunfire brought down an Afghan passenger plane, killing all 29 on board. And in Pakistan, a huge explosion at an ammunition depot killed more than 100 people. Some of the weapons destroyed were reportedly earmarked for the Afghan rebels, and Pakistan is investigating the possibility of sabotage. Elsewhere, the U.S. military was targeted for attacks during the week. 5 people, including a U.S. Navy enlisted woman, were killed in Naples when a bomb was set off outside a USO club. Navy Lieutenant Dave Morris says some Americans were among the 20 other people injured.
There were 4 sailors from 2 of the U.S. ships in port that were injured. 3 sailors off the USS Capodanno, one of whom had minor injuries. 2 of the other sailors off the Capodanno were admitted last night, and they're in stable condition and remain here at the hospital. 1 sailor off the USS Paul was also admitted last night to the hospital, and he is also in stable condition right now.
And according to ABC's Bob Haberle, the police have a lead in the case.
The plane authorities authorities have released a composite drawing of an Asian man they believe may have been responsible for last night's USO bombing. They say he's in his late 30s and believe he may be part of the Japanese Red Army faction.
Another attack on the U.S. military was not as deliberate, but it sent a Navy ship into port for repairs. The USS Samuel Roberts had been escorting reflagged Kuwaiti oil tankers in the Persian Gulf when it hit a mine, injuring 10 sailors. ABC's Ron Bagnulo tells us...
Where the Roberts was hit is 70 miles east of Bahrain, and anywhere north of that area is an area where a lot of mine hunting goes on. It's not too far south from Farsi Island. Ironically, it's almost in the same location where the Stark was hit by an Iraqi missile almost 1 year ago.
37 sailors were killed in that incident. In Panama, Marine sentries were checking into a possible intrusion by Panamanian military forces at a fuel storage base when one of the sentries got between two groups of his buddies who opened fire. As Captain Nancy Lalontes told us...
Initial indications are that the gunshot wound was not the result of hostile gunfire, but rather the result of crossfire from the U.S. shots fired.
The Marine died. The night after that incident, U.S. troops and other intruders shot it out for about 2 hours. No casualties were reported. The hijacking of a Kuwaiti airliner that started on April the 5th continued throughout the week. The gunman murdered a second hostage to reinforce their demands that officials at the airport in Cyprus allow the 747 jet to be refueled. Threats to kill more people were diffused by the Palestine Liberation Organization, which entered the negotiations to free the hostages. The plane was refueled, and the hijackers responded by releasing 12 more people. They were checked over by the Cypriot health minister.
Some of them, they are suffering from the strain and anxiety state, but after they had a bath and a meal, they look better.
The jet then took off for Algiers, with the hijacker still demanding that Kuwait free 17 terrorists jailed in that country. A relative of one of the murdered hostages says Kuwait should hang tough.
There's no doubt we should neither surrender nor give in to them. They are inhuman. The way they tortured them, the way they threw them.
Funerals for the two Kuwaitis whose bodies were thrown from the jet were held in their native country during the week. Thousands jammed the funeral procession. Meantime, in Algiers, ABC's Greg Dobbs says the hostages got a physical.
At the insistence of the Algerian negotiators, a doctor visited some of the hostages on board and came back out reporting them all satisfactorily, physically well. He said they were worn down and tired, but physically and emotionally okay.
One more hostage was released as the negotiations continued, leaving about 30 on board. And at week's end, it was anyone's guess when the hijacking might be resolved. In Israel, Palestinians staged another general strike in the occupied territories to protest the deportation of more Palestinians to southern Lebanon. Some of the bloodiest demonstrations in the past 4 months broke out at week's end when word spread throughout the occupied territories that a PLO official had been assassinated in Tunis. The PLO says the Israelis are responsible. The Israelis say the dead man had masterminded much of the recent unrest. The U.S. airline, which handles about 20% of this country's air traffic, is being put under a government microscope.
I am announcing the Department of Transportation is launching a preliminary investigation of Texas Air Corporation and its management.
Transportation Secretary James Burnley saying that he wants to determine Texas Air's financial stability and whether the carrier is disposed to comply with safety rules. Texas Air owns Continental and Eastern Airlines, and FAA head Alan McCarter has his sights on Eastern.
I'm announcing a special investigation of Eastern Airlines and a proposed civil penalty against the carrier of $823,000.
The investigation revolves around financial problems and how they might impact on safety. The head of the Machinists Union at Eastern, Charles Bryan, says...
There's real evidence of real problems, and they're very serious problems, and they're far-reaching.
But as far as the safety of the flying public is concerned, Texas Air Chairman Frank Lorenzo says...
In my 16 years in this business, safety has never taken second place.
In fact, Transportation Secretary Burnley gave no indication that any of Texas Air's operations were unsafe. Mixed signals from the economy this week. Retail sales figures for March were up solidly, marking the fifth monthly gain in a row. But the balance of trade was something else. February's trade deficit grew to just under $14 billion, something which surprised analysts in and out of government. One of those private experts, Chris Catton of Data Resources, says that attempts to drive down the dollar against foreign currencies should have paid off with a lower deficit figure.
When the dollar goes down, it drives up the price of the imports that we are buying. So you have to kind of reduce the quantity of imports faster than the prices are going up. It takes a long, long time for depreciation to turn the monthly figures around, but it should have been happening by now, and everybody believed that it was up until now.
On top of the bad trade figures, March's wholesale price index went up sharply, raising fears of higher inflation. But as ABC's Tony Sargent tells us, another statistic might have tempered those fears somewhat.
The Federal Reserve says the nation's total industrial output rose hardly at all last month, partly because output by utilities fell sharply. The second straight month of lukewarm industrial production could offset a bit of the inflation worry triggered by the latest wholesale price and foreign trade figures.
Although Wall Street closed Friday's session with a gain, the trade figures triggered a 100-point loss in the Dow Industrial Average the day before, something that doesn't worry Edward Kirshner of Payne Weber.
We've had a lot of good news on the economy, profits, unemployment, and we've had a market that's up 400 points in 6 months. I think we're simply keeping things in a pretty healthy balance here, not letting the market go too far, too fast.
Automated program trading was stopped under the New York Stock Exchange rules when the Dow had declined 50 points. But the fact that the trading continued with such vigor when switched to manual raised questions about such a ban on computer trading. The rules are an outgrowth of last October's 508-point plunge in the Dow. The Senate approved its version of the next fiscal budget this week, voting to spend $1.1 trillion. The Senate breached its own spending ceiling by earmarking an extra $2.6 billion to anti-drug programs. On the drug issue, the Senate declined to impose sanctions on the Bahamas for failing to do enough in the war against drugs. But when sanctions against Mexico were discussed, California Republican Pete Wilson argued for them.
More marijuana and heroin come from Mexico than from any other nation, and that it is a major source or point of transshipment for cocaine, and a growing point of transshipment.
62 of Wilson's fellow senators agreed with him and voted for sanctions against Mexico. 27 senators were opposed. ABC's Vic Ratner analyzes the vote.
The move is mainly symbolic. Sponsors said the lopsided vote shows how frustrated Congress has been with the failure of efforts to cut down on drug smuggling. It does set up a confrontation between the Senate and President Reagan. The president had certified to Congress that Mexico was cooperating fully with American drug control efforts.
Under a 1986 law, unless the president certifies that a foreign country is fully cooperating in the anti-drug effort, it must lose half its U.S. aid. As most of us rush to meet this week's deadline for filing our income taxes, one of the wealthiest couples in the country was charged with evading some $4 million in taxes. The two are Harry and Leona Helmsley. They own some of the priciest real estate in Manhattan, and U.S. Attorney Rudolph Giuliani says some phony billing was involved.
Millions of dollars in personal expenditures for the Helmsley mansion and estate known as Donnellan Hall were charged falsely to business entities. The defendants are alleged to have created phony books and records to make it falsely appear that personal expenditures were in fact business expenditures.
Leona Helmsley is additionally charged with extorting kickbacks from contractors and suppliers. She and her husband say they're innocent. The government issued its first patent for a higher life form this week, granting Harvard University the patent for genetically altered mice. ABC's Bettina Gregory explains what's involved.
Mice have a human gene, and they're very sensitive to cancer-causing chemicals. This means they'll develop tumors quickly, and they can be tested by giving them the normal human doses of a substance instead of the usual method of testing, which is feeding them massive doses of the suspected cancer-causing substance.
The patent has outraged groups which object to such tinkering with genetics. Jeremy Rifkin says life is not just another consumer product.
What the patent office is saying by this decision is that all forms of life are now indistinguishable from microwave ovens, automobiles, and other patented products in the past.
Rifkin says his national coalition to halt animal patenting will take its fight to Congress. Among this week's obituaries, that of the South African author Alan Paton. Jim Hickey outlines his career.
His first book was his most famous. Cry, the Beloved Country, was author Alan Paton's anguished description of black suffering under apartheid. South Africa's system of racial separation. Written in 1948, it has sold 15 million copies in 20 languages. Peyton was a leading voice against apartheid and won worldwide acclaim for his writing. He has been described as a visionary who throughout his adult life battled against racism in his country. He called himself a workaholic and on his 85th birthday this year said he finally planned to become a dropout. Alan Peyton died at his home near Durban this morning of cancer. Jim Hickey, ABC News, Johannesburg.
The Arizona Supreme Court has decided the fate of that state's impeached governor, Evan Makem, who was ousted from office last week. Makem had been slated to face a recall election next month, an election some said was unnecessary. The Arizona Supreme Court agreed and ordered its cancellation. The ruling means that Arizona's new governor, Rose Mofford, will serve out Makem's term, which runs through 1990. Larry Speaks is out of a job again. The former White House news secretary, who quit to take a public relations job with the Wall Street firm of Merrill Lynch, resigned that job this week in the wake of the controversy created by his new book about his days at the White House. In the book, Speaks said he made up quotes for President Reagan and passed them on to the news media.
I was not aware of that and just learned it recently, as all the rest of you did, and the words in his book, and I can tell you right now that I have no affection for these kiss-and-tell books that are being written, and I find them entirely fiction.
Speaks says that on the whole, his book is honest. Robert Byrd ended months of speculation this week when he announced that he would step down as the Senate Majority Leader when the next president takes office in January.
I will continue to do my best in a different role for the Senate and for the country.
That different role being as President Pro Tem of the Senate. Byrd's announcement has created a wide-open race for the majority leader's jobs. The three contenders for the Democratic presidential nomination were working the crowds in New York all week as they got ready for next Tuesday's primary. 255 delegates are at stake, and all three candidates were hoping that Governor Mario Cuomo would throw them his endorsement. He did not.
One of these fellows is going to be the starting quarterback, but the other two are going to be playing too. I want to see all three of them as strong as possible at the end of this process. I don't want any of them debilitated. I want each one of them as strong as possible.
Jesse Jackson may have picked up a little strength by the endorsement New York Mayor Ed Koch made.
I will support whoever is the candidate chosen at my party's national convention. I hope the winner will be Senator Albert Gore of Tennessee.
Koch's endorsement may get Gore a bigger share of the Jewish vote in New York City, but at the expense of Michael Dukakis. Dukakis spent part of his time questioning Vice President George Bush's foreign policy experience.
He's the guy that sat next to the president and did nothing while we traded arms to the Ayatollah for hostages. He's the fellow that went to the Philippines in the early 80s and commended Marcos and his commitment to democracy. He continues to support a failed and illegal policy in Central America.
The vice president was upstaged by a group of giggling toddlers when he visited a government daycare center in Washington. A reporter asked a question about Jesse Jackson's candidacy, and the kids began chanting Jackson's name. Bush grinned, then said he wasn't going to talk about the Democratic side of the race at a daycare center. President Reagan was not so inclined, saying he thinks Jackson's campaign is drawing more attention because he is black rather than because of his policy proposals. And on those policies, Mr. Reagan said,
a great many of us would find ourselves in great disagreement with the policies that he is proposing and would perhaps be more vocal about them if it wasn't for concern that that be misinterpreted into some kind of a racial attack.
Jackson took note of the president's remarks while campaigning in New York.
I know why Reagan is reacting to this campaign. Because some people who voted for him are now voting for me.
Another candidate making news during the week was Sonny Bono, who defeated six other candidates to become California's latest celebrity mayor, the mayor of Palm Springs.
I feel elated. I'm in shock, kind of, because you fight for a day, you never really think it's going to come, and then when it gets here, I really went comatose today. I became absolute bread mold all day.
The night before, Sonny Bono was elected, his former wife and singing partner Cher won Hollywood's biggest prize, an Oscar, as best actress for her role in the picture Moonstruck.
This represents 23 or 24 years of my work. And I've never won anything before from my peers. I'm really, really happy. I'd like to thank everyone I worked on with the movie. They were really fabulous.
The Oscar for Best Actor went to Kirk Douglas's son, Michael, for his part in Wall Street. Douglas dedicated his award to his parents and step-parents.
In particular, to my father, who I don't think ever missed one of my college productions, for his continued support, and for helping a son step out of the shadow.
The good fortune Moonstruck brought Cher rubbed off on Olympia Dukakis, who won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress, and she's hoping the luck will filter on through to her cousin, the presidential candidate.
Thank you very much. Okay, Michael, let's go!
For Sean Connery, winning the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor in The Untouchables put him between the proverbial rock and hard place.
Winning this award, it creates a certain dilemma because I had decided, if I'd had the good fortune to win, that I would give it to my wife, who deserves it. But this evening I discovered backstage that they're worth $15,000. And now I'm not so sure.
Big winner of the night was the picture, The Last Emperor. The music won for Best Score, but the biggest prize among the nine Oscars was Best Picture. Jeremy Thomas produced The Last Emperor.
I'd say this is a truly imperial evening for me and for everybody who worked very hard with me on this picture. I'd like to thank about 30,000 people who helped us make. It took 4 years to make and was very, very rewarding.
It was a rewarding week as well for Sandy Lyle, who became the first British golfer to win the 52nd Masters Golf Tournament in Augusta. I'll have the story of big bucks and complete trust when World News This Week continues in a moment.
Corner of West Elm and State, victim is a male in his 70s.
What happened?
It's Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Johnson from down the street?
Yes.
I'm McGruff, the crime dog. Ed Johnson was walking down the block when he became the victim of a crime. Turns out Ed was lucky. All he lost was his wallet. Don't let crime get the best of older folks in your neighborhood. Get together with your neighbors and start a senior citizen escort group. It's as easy as giving a friend a lift on your way home from work.
All set, Mrs. Finley?
All set, Fred. And I really do thank you.
Or walking him to the grocery store on the corner.
I guess we're here, Harold.
Thanks for walking me, Beth.
Oh, Harold, my pleasure.
When you walk along with a senior citizen, you're telling crime to take a hike. That's one way to make your neighborhood safer for older folks. Find out more about crime prevention. Call up your local police or sheriff's department and, help take a bite out of crime.
A message from the Crime Prevention Coalition and the Ad Council.
It would have been too obvious on April Fool's Day, so Ron Chapman, a DJ at KVIL-FM in Dallas, decided to pull his little on-air stunt the day before, telling his listeners...
Go to your checkbook. Write a check. Make it in the amount of $20.
Broadcast evangelists get money that way all the time, although they promise salvation. But Chapman?
No one has ever done that. No one has ever had the chutzpah to simply go on the air and say, send money for no reason.
And, don't you know, the checks started pouring in. Gene McGaw was one of the contributors.
I just trust him. There's just a trust that he's built, I think, with everybody in the community.
Must have been a lot of trustful souls in Dallas, because when they got done counting, the listeners had sent Ron Chapman $240,000. Now he's got to figure out what to do with it.
We don't want anyone unhappy to think we've hoodwinked them. We think that they had a lot of faith in us that we'll do something good.
Chapman says one or more charities will likely end up with the fruits of his listeners' generosity. And those are the people and stories that made World News This Week. World News This Week was written and produced by Gil Longin, engineering by Cy Kantrowitz and Tom Kennedy. I'm Roger Skibanis, ABC News, New York. World News This Week is a presentation of ABC News.